I've been alone for so long. And when I realized that the laboratory was having the same name, first name and last name, of the evil that had been plaguing us, I thought to myself, that's up. Listen to what I'm saying.
John, I'll tell you what I'm suspicious of. I'll tell you what I'm suspicious of. I'm suspicious of the Daytona Beach Spring Break Herpes Lab. That might be where all the herpes comes from.
I've been to that lab.
Oh, I know. Oh, I know.
Can I say this about science?
You can say anything you want about some of my best friends are scientists.
And I love them, and they do such good work, but they are going to kill us all.
Atomic bomb, baby, atomic bomb.
Atomic bomb, because they're still people. So you have the atomic bomb, and if you cut the atom this way, it can power the world with electricity. And if you cut it that way, it can blow everything up. Guess which one we tried first? Like, that's just who we are. Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, there was the 1918. You remember the last pandemic, right?
Sure.
So a bunch of scientists.
Yes, I've read up.
1918, they had a sample that I guess had been in the whatever permafrost lab in the 1918. So the idea was they were going to reanimate it. Mm. So that they could study it. The 1918 pandemic flu. They had a little sample of it, and it hadn't been a scourge in the earth for 100 years. And they thought to themselves, what if we just, I don't know, woke it up? And nobody in the room was like, no. Let's not do that. But they did that. Here's how I believe the world ends. And I say this to you in sincerity. Okay. It does not end. We are a screwed up world. There's racism, income inequality, fascism, authoritarianism, all these horrible, horrible things, natural resources that run down, that'll all be fine. The world ends, the last words man utters are somewhere in a lab. A guy goes, it worked.
I do not think we can celebrate the achievement of that science enough. It'll fundamentally change science. It'll change the pace of medical innovation. Those mRNA vaccines, maybe therapies for cancers in the future. You know, I've
never gotten a clearer signal on my 5G phone before. It's amazing. It's amazing the coverage I get now.
All the extra benefits, yes.
Now, I got to ask you something that's on a lot of people's minds, is that you say that science, you know, one of the things that science does is that it approaches information with humility and it changes as new information comes in. Mm. What about the origins of the coronavirus? Because many people, including a dear friend of mine...
Yes, I heard.
...believe that it's got to be the Wuhan coronavirus, novel coronavirus lab. Why else would they name it that if they didn't make it? Now, you're laughing, but I'm just curious what you think of that rationale, and is there new information? I know that there's this idea, this theory has been updrafted recently, and is there any evidence? Because I don't want to be right. I just want to know what the truth is. What do we know so far?
Yeah.
I do want to be right.
I think that this really has to be investigated. I mean, I think, the lab leak theory was dismissed by a lot of people and used for political sort of gamemanship without any evidence. There was no evidence that it leaked from a lab. There's no evidence that it didn't leak from a lab. Sort of the nature of science again.
Why has it come back around again? And people like Anthony Fauci and Francis Collins and Annie Ash are saying no, it should definitely be investigated.
Yeah, I think there's a few reasons. I did this interview with Robert Redfield, who was head of the CDC at the time, and he came out and said, this was in February of this year, that he thinks that that's likely how this escaped, and he's someone who had access to raw intelligence and raw data, and when you start to look at the pieces, like were there people who got sick in that Institute of Virology? They got sick in October, November timeframe. Huh, that's interesting because we thought this didn't really start to hit the scene until end of December. So they got sick. Was that sickness caused by COVID? Was it caused by something else? We come to find out, as I heard from other people, that lots of personal protective equipment was being purchased in China from other countries, including the United States, at least 30 days before the rest of the world was given notice. Did they know something? Was something known? We don't have evidence to say that proves to a lab leak theory, but I think
that points to deception.
It points to deception,
but it doesn't point to.
But why deception? No, Absolutely. So this idea that it was biomanufactured as a weapon somehow versus an accidental lab leak versus a natural jump from animals to humans, those are really the three things on the table. The bioweapon part of it, I think most people don't really think that that's what happened. But the idea that this virus could have been studied in the lab, could have been increasingly exposed to human cells, and accidentally leaked out of the lab is a theory that I think is very worthy of investigation. There's something else. Typically, when a virus jumps from animals to humans, it kind of sputters along. It takes a while for it to sort of gain steam. As was explained to me, this thing came out 90 miles an hour and all of a sudden just started infecting wildly. Why? Well, if it had been studied in a lab and exposed to human cells, it was becoming more and more efficient. It was becoming smarter at the time that it leaked. It was a huge problem.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
The preceding show was recorded at Wave Farms WGXC in the Hudson Valley in New York State.
For some reason or another, you sound a little taller on radio.
This Saturday, June 19th, there will be a Juneteenth celebration hosted by the African American Cultural Center of the Capital Region. Joining me to talk about this event is Trayvon Jackson, Executive Director of the African American Cultural Center of the Capital Region. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
What can you tell us about the event happening this weekend?
Yes. So this Juneteenth celebration is our 17th annual in the city of Albany and the fourth in the South End neighborhood. It is the celebration of freedom for enslaved persons of color in the United States. It was on June 19, 1865, that General Gordon Granger delivered Order Number 3 with Union troops to the South, declaring that those persons were in fact free.
So what can the public expect when they go to this event this weekend?
Absolutely. Well, they can expect a friendly, welcoming environment. That's because we'll be closing off South Pearl Street from Madison to Morton, and encouraging the neighbors and residents to come out and celebrate with us. There will also be 30 to 40 vendors on the street, as well as our reflection garden with live performances and outdoor art installations and murals above our reflection ponds with our rescue turtles. There are kids programs as well on the interior of the building, as long as our permanent exhibitions. And there are other activities and parking facilities available adjacent at the South End Grocery.
And so it's going to be a mix of both educational activities and entertainment, such as, the vendors, you have places to shop. There is a movie night. And I also heard there's a libation ceremony, which many of our listeners may not be familiar with. Could you talk about what are the opportunities to see something a little bit different this weekend?
Yeah. So with respect to, libation ceremonies, those are most commonly used for Kwanzaa. With respect to Juneteenth, our ceremony specifically is to open with remarks and induction, as well as lift every voice and sing. And that is our celebration and opening ceremony. With regards to other things you may not expect, many people do not spend time in the South End neighborhood for recreational purposes. And I think that will go a long way towards helping understand the beauty and the vibrancy of the neighborhood and the existing residents and businesses that are there.
So you mentioned that this is the 17th year that the Juneteenth celebration is happening in Albany. How have you noticed the public understanding of Juneteenth and the history of enslaved people in the U.S. changing over time?
I would say it's been very gradual and stagnant in many respects. I think in terms of education, you know, I do these news runs and pressers every year, and a lot of it is the same education by and large for the masses, and the average person is not deeply aware of the struggle, the degradation, and the slavery that was subjected to persons of color and the oppressed in this country. And it's events like these that provide the opportunity for the deeper knowledge and education so that you can affect those who are open and receptive to building a congenial bond.
Is the African American Cultural Center also involved in public school education or any school education? Are there programs that are happening in our school system to make people more aware of this history?
Yeah, we do direct outreach with the school districts and schools on an individual basis, at a district-wide level, of course, that would need to be implemented in a greater magnitude to catch on. But of course, with COVID impacting our educational system in the last year, much of the progress and traction of those conversations is starting anew.
Is there one piece that you find is most important to understand when we talk about Juneteenth and the history of enslaved people? What do you feel like is the most important piece for the public to understand and that maybe is less talked about?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think with respect to what is or is not talked about, you know, you're dealing with a population that is largely ignorant to the meaning. So there's not much context to compare to in that respect. I think one thing that should be taken away is that it is a celebration of freedom of peoples. And that was independent from freedom as it was determined in this country. The entire point and purpose of this holiday is in fact history. It is the history of an event in this country that impacts the majority of persons who claim some type of African descent. So I believe that it is very important to understand the people that we share borders, homes, neighborhoods, restaurants, and space with beyond a cursory experience.
Is there something that you would really like to see change to further public understanding? Is there, what are some things that you would like to see implemented, whether it be in the education system or just public understanding or events happening in the Capital Region?
I think there are a variety of events that happen in the Capital Region. I mean, obviously, for an educational standpoint, I would prefer a more expansive discussion than just Juneteenth. You know, I'll trade some Juneteenth awareness for a deeper understanding that correctly depicts the civil rights movement and accurately depicts some of the spying and techniques that they were subjected to by the federal government of the United States. Because with that context, it becomes much easier and much more fluid to understand and empathize with things and concepts like Juneteenth that predate all of us that are currently alive. So that, I believe, is really a key unique point for reflection. But it's a much broader initiative, and I would not pretend that is an easy endeavor for a school district or any other party. That's why we exist where we do, to try and fill the gaps.
If listeners are interested to coming to the African American Cultural Center, first, what are the restrictions right now? Are people able to visit the center? And when it is open, what can the public see and learn at your center?
Yeah, so people can visit now. You just have to ring the bell. Of course, we'll do a temperature check and observe social distancing, and you can ultimately indicate your level of comfort with disclosing vaccination status. However, we do not force those questions. We can social distance and adequately comply with the regulations while maintaining that level of privacy. Once you're inside, of course, we have our permanent exhibitions and our redone first and second floor gallery spaces. This also includes music and performance spaces, as well as private workspaces for artists and residents who produce ongoing works and shows, and they have studio space that is provided for them at no cost. So there are a variety of things to enjoy when you come to the African American Cultural Center.
Is there currently an exhibition, an art exhibition happening, the Herstory?
Yes, well, there's always an exhibition. But yes, her story is still up, but actually was just moved within the building because we have mounted another new installation that will be debuted at Juneteenth. This is artist Tai Tan. These are three-dimensional installations that depict visually what urban life is for those in Albany, New York, and beyond when you identify with the African-American experience.
Wonderful. What is the website? How can our listeners find more information about the African-American Cultural Center?
Yeah, so the website is www.baaccr.org. And on the website, you can see some of the brief elements of history. It collects all of our social media channels and information about our events and programs. And of course, if you want to learn more about what we propose to the public, and that is the history and contribution of African Americans, we have artifacts, books, and collections here on site that we can review either virtually or can discuss in person should you choose to visit.
Great. And how do our listeners find out more information about the Juneteenth event happening this weekend?
Yes, so you could visit our website, visit our Facebook page. Of course, we will have some new stories running very shortly on Spectrum and other networks that'll provide even more detail. And our print ad just ran in this Sunday's Times Union newspaper with a full outline of our programming.
Wonderful. Anything else that needs to be added into this conversation?
That we welcome all individuals who consider themselves allies to our movement to bring love and congeniality to all peoples and do that with a context and understanding of our unique struggle as African Americans. So we hope to see you and welcome you on Saturday to accomplish just that.
Thank you for taking the time to speak with me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about organizing in Vermont, and as someone that's an organizer in Vermont, what's that experience like?
Well, I'm very new to the organizing community. I've been in it for about a year now. And prior to organizing, I kind of seen things happening around me. But in terms of just the place that I'm from, which is Vermont, there wasn't really that much stuff going on in terms of demonstration. I believe for some reason, Vermont was just not very active, especially even after the murdering of George Floyd. So I'm a part of this organization called, I'm actually one of the co-founders of this organization called The Black Perspective, and we're based in Vermont. And we started off demonstrating, you know, just doing demonstration in Vermont, and it's been very successful. We've had over, you know, 1,000 people show up to our demonstration, and that was like start off. You know, we had no prior experience demonstrating, but like it was very successful, and we knew that we had the skills, so we just continue on doing that for a while. Then slowly, what we started doing was like, okay, we got to focus on education too. You know, I believe like after people go home, they still need to go home and know what to do when they go home. After you're done chanting Black Lives Matter, what do you do? What do you do inside your house? What are the conversations about? You know, who do you need to talk to? Because really, we have to understand the people that are doing this this damage, the people that are working in the system, do have family members. They're not people that are aliens. They're human beings. They have brothers and sisters, and their brothers and sisters are probably attending Black Lives Matter protests. So you should also be talking to your uncle, who is a police officer, that's probably a part of the system that is destroying Black people and minorities in general.
And tell us specifically what kind of organizing, what kind of actions have you all been doing in Burlington and Vermont over the last year?
Of course, yes. So we started off obviously with the demonstrations, and then slowly we started doing community events, and then we did a encampment at Battery Park, Burlington, Vermont. We did a month-long encampment, and it was very successful. We got one officer fired, but we wanted three of them fired, but we only got one, and it was good for one. You know, it's like it's whatever. We didn't really think there was going to be that much success because of the fact that we just thought the police were not going to listen to us. But it was successful. We did it for a month. We got one officer fired. But what was going on within that encampment that was also very beautiful was that we were doing mutual aid. We were taking care of the homeless community, and we were feeding them, and we were feeding anyone that really came to the park. So that was something that was beautiful about the encampment. We were, just educating everybody that came to the encampment. People slept there. Whoever that could slept there. Whoever that didn't want to sleep there, they came when there were demonstrations. Like, we had, like, a schedule for daily activities, so people knew what was happening and when it was happening. And it was very organized. And the best part was it was ran 100% by black people, meaning there were white people all over the spot, but we just made the decision to decenter white leadership. And everybody was okay with that. And it was great. We were not, abusing white people there. Everybody was working together. We made sure that everybody was treated fairly and equally. But it was beautiful. It was a great environment. And, you can definitely read about it. It was the Battery Park encampment in Burlington, Vermont.
Can you talk about some of the challenges that face black people in particular in Vermont, and also black activists and organizers? I know Vermont is a majority white state, and that's not to ignore the diversity of folks that do live there, but it also has, I think, too, a lot of people see Vermont as a uniquely very progressive state, but that might also cover up a lot of the the racism and the history of that in Vermont. So can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so it is true. People view Vermont to be very progressive, but the reality is completely different. I have seen people get mistreated by the police department numerous times, and there was no action that was taken to give those individuals justice. And one of the main reasons why those individuals were not given justice is because we just did not cover it. And I mean, honestly, I'm gonna have to try to just name drop some of the people that were involved. It's gonna have to be the media. I think the media plays a huge role in this. So when there is this incident where there's clearly racism, the media would not cover it because people don't want to read about that. And so for that reason, people don't even know that it's happening. And then in addition, obviously, even if the media doesn't cover it, injustice is injustice. It doesn't have to go into the media for people to for it to be deemed as injustice. I think that is very clear. But obviously, that just shows where they stand in terms of their default behavior when it comes to racism, which is to not address it. So Vermont is definitely a state that needs to definitely change its way.
More recently, there's been an upsurge of protests in the U.S. and also around the world, specifically in response to, apartheid in Israel and Palestine and the Israeli military assault on Palestinians and ethnic cleansing there. In the background, we can both hear Burmese revolutionary songs that are being sung. We're here just outside of a Burmese rally in Utica, organized by the peoples from Burma, Myanmar, who live here in Utica in solidarity with their revolution at home. Can you talk a little more about, there's Palestine, there's Burma, all these other issues, and how are they related? How are they connected? Where do you see that connection?
Well, I believe in something that's called collective liberation. So obviously when black people needed support from the community, the general world, people came out and protested and supported us, especially when George Floyd was murdered. That is not a one-way thing. And what I mean by that is black people are going to have to do the same for other communities. Just because the person that got murdered wasn't black doesn't necessarily mean that it's not a black problem. Because it's the system that murdered that even, for example, white person was the same system that murdered that black person. Because when you really look into this issue, there's also class involved. So even poor immigrants, poor white people, all of them are all involved in this situation. And they're all people that are going to be needing our support. And we have to come together to dismantle this general system. And, obviously race is a huge problem, but class and also obviously our immigration system is all, it's all just the same. And black people are going to have to take the stand and support all these different other issues, even outside of America, because if we're going to expect other people to say Black Lives Matter, then we're going to have to, you know, do the same thing for other people that are saying our lives matter too. You know, I think that just makes sense. So collective liberation is something that is very important, and black people are going to have to support all these other problems, because together we're going to get exactly what we want.
And I want to dig a little deeper at just your personal thoughts on the past year specifically. I mean, you said yourself, you're a newer activist, newer organizer. Black Lives Matter is really the largest upsurge in rebellion of sorts since the rebellion of the 1960s and 70s in this country. It's not as big as it was, say, last summer or when it started, but, you know, as you're showing in Burlington, Vermont, organizing is still going on. But a lot's happened this year with the rebellion, with the, you know, killings from police officers, with the pandemic and all these other things. I mean, as someone that's newer in this movement, how do you keep going without getting burnt out?
Well, you gotta have allies. First things first, this job does not pay. You don't get paid to be an activist. I'm sorry. It just doesn't happen. You just have to have the passion, and you're just gonna have to have the will. I mean, even not just an activist, also the people that are also involved in the activist community, like, obviously, reporters and photographers, they're all individuals that might not be getting as much money as they should, especially to cover something like this, because of the fact that it's just, there's no system in place that will support this. Actually, the system is against you doing something like that, because you're going against them. So it's very unfortunate. But for me, as a new activist, the way I deal with it is by surrounding myself with the right people, and making sure that I'm taking a step back when I need to just like, you know, just like, focus on myself, do something different that is not the type of work that I'm doing right now. Because I think that is very important. You can't just be on this type of work 24/7, because you're gonna have mental health is something that is very important within activism. Like, people don't want to take the step back because they believe that if they take a step back, the revolution is going to be slowed down. But really, in reality, the revolution will never slow down. You have to take a step back so that the revolution can keep going. So you have to take that step back. You know, I think it's very important. So mental health is very important. Surrounding yourself with the right people and making sure that you're a part of some sort of coalition, some sort of system, so that you guys can at least find a way to fund yourselves. Because really, you still have bills to pay. You still have, you know, things that you have to pay for. So being with in a coalition is going to help at least create some sort of a source of income for you to support yourself. But yes, it's just like surrounding yourself with the right people, taking a step back. Mental health is very important. And, you know, at the end of the day, really, you're the most important part of this whole situation. So you have to make sure you take care of yourself, because we need you to be at your best self, so that you can perform at your best and give the best speech, you know. So it's very important for you to take care of yourself. So self-care it is.
WGXC believes in creative use of the airwaves. WGXC is a program division of the nonprofit arts organization Waveform, based in Acre, New York. We are the only station in the country to dedicate significant airtime to radio as an artistic medium. Tune into transmission art and experimental sound programming overnight and on Saturdays, and hear artists from all over the world who sculpt and compose with the airwaves.
All's my life I has to fight. All's my life I hard times like yeah, bad trips like yeah, Nazareth.
And when
I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11, even boom with the bass down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in the twilight. We're pretty, and it's the highlight. I tell my mama I love her, but this what I like, Lord knows. 20 of them in my Chevy, tell them all to come and get me. Reaping everything I sow, so my karma come in heaven. No preliminary hearings on my record, I'm a mother. Silence for the record, tell the world I knew.
Hello, I'm Pamela Badilla of Jata Jata International Folkloric Theater, and you are listening to WGXC 90.7 FM, Accra, Catskill, Hudson, Greenport, Claverack, Kinderhook, so many towns and villages and cities in Columbia and Greene County. This is listener-supported hands-on radio.
One of the local community events on the WGXC community calendar is the Toolshed Exchange Tool Library Grand Opening event, Sunday, June 20th from 1 to 3 p.m. behind Basilica Hudson in Hudson. The Toolshed Exchange is a tool lending library that will provide Hudson area residents access to a variety of tools and trainings. The opening event features a ribbon cutting with Mayor Kamal Johnson and tool demonstrations, and live music by Brass Kill. It's all from 1 to 3 p.m., Sunday, June 20th, outside of Basilica Hudson, for the Toolshed Exchange Tool Library Grand Opening. So turn out and find out more information about any event like this in the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
2 weeks, 14 days, 326 hours. Every second that your family could be exposed to radiation after a nuclear attack. Radiation that kills.
To survive, a fallout shelter is a necessity. Equipment and supplies are essential.
Now, Survive All Shelters, one of the nation's leading manufacturers of fallout shelters, offers a basic equipment kit with
a Conelrad high-powered radio, transistor-operated for long battery life,
a complete, fully stocked first aid kit,
a heavy-duty fire extinguisher, emergency water containers, a chemical toilet for protection against contamination and disease,
extra-strength Saran and Rayon bunks,
a radiation meter and individual dosimeters.
For protection every second of each hour of every day. See a survive-all shelter now.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Ralph Gartner of Volusia, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
90.7 FM.
Accra, Hudson, Catskill.
Pentagon Papers at 50. Press freedom and whistleblowers still at risk. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. Legendary whistleblower Dan Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers 50 years ago, a courageous act of truth-telling for which he later faced life in prison. He hasn't stopped since. Last May, just weeks after turning 90, Ellsberg made yet another disclosure of classified national security information. He was speaking on a panel I moderated with another whistleblower, Edward Snowden, at a University of Massachusetts conference called Truth, Dissent, and the Legacy of Daniel Ellsberg.
Let me tell a truth that I've had here for 50 years.
said Dan Ellsberg before reading from a secret 1958 report describing the willingness of U.S. officials to launch a nuclear war.
I copied that study. It was in my top secret safe in 1969, and I've had it ever since.
Ellsberg was working at the Rand Corporation and as a consultant to the Kennedy administration. He was also a U.S. Marine officer and participated in combat missions in Vietnam. In 1969, inspired by the growing anti-war and draft resistance movements, Ellsberg photocopied the Pentagon Papers, a secret 7,000-page history of U.S. decision-making during the Vietnam War. Unable to find a U.S. senator willing to take the documents, he leaked them to the New York Times. The Times published its first Pentagon Papers piece on June 13, 1971. 2 days later, a federal court granted President Richard Nixon's request for an injunction blocking further publication. After Ellsberg's identity as a leaker became public, he and his wife Patricia went underground as he continued to distribute copies of the documents to other newspapers. Nixon's national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, called Ellsberg the most dangerous man in America. Nixon, in a recorded Oval Office conversation with his attorney general, said,
"We've got to keep our eye on the main ball. The main ball's Ellsberg. We got to get this son of a bitch."
On June 30th, 1971, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the New York Times, barring government censorship of the press and allowing continued publication of the Pentagon Papers. Nixon intensified his campaign targeting the whistleblower, afraid of what he might release next. As Ellsberg recounted on the Democracy Now! NewsHour,
"He burglarized my former psychoanalyst office. He sent 12 Cuban assets of the Bay of Pigs up to incapacitate me totally on the steps of the Capitol. On May 3rd, he overheard me on illegal, warrantless wiretaps."
When the Nixon administration's misconduct was revealed, the judge threw out the espionage case against Ellsberg. Dan Ellsberg's example has encouraged other whistleblowers, among them Edward Snowden, who, while a contractor at the National Security Agency, participated in the development of the government's secret global dragnet surveillance program. He leaked a massive trove of documents in 2013 and has lived in exile in Russia ever since. At the conference on May 1st, Snowden said of whistleblowers who inspired him,
"They had stood up at great personal risk to tell the public an essential truth that was being intentionally denied to them for political purpose. Eventually, you believe that this is what looks more right than going back into the office and perpetuating a system of injustice quietly day after day." Reality Winner and Daniel Hale and Chelsea Manning, Thomas Drake, Terry Albury, and others who have come forward in the last decades, they really prove and have, I think, vindicated Daniel Ellsberg's approach to the wrongdoing that he saw so many decades ago, because the abuse of power is not something that's going away.
Reality Winner was an NSA contractor when she leaked information to the press describing alleged Russian interference in the 2016 elections. Imprisoned for over 4 years, she was released on June 2nd to a halfway house for the remaining months of her sentence. Her family is demanding a pardon. Daniel Hale pled guilty to leaking documents about the U.S. drone program of targeted assassinations in Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq, which he participated in while in the Air Force. He will be sentenced in mid-July. Dan Ellsberg's May 1st disclosure was about a 1958 conflict over several small islands between mainland China and Taiwan. The U.S., Ellsberg revealed, drew up plans to launch nuclear weapons against China to support Taiwan. The report predicted that a U.S. first strike on China would provoke a nuclear counterstrike by the Soviet Union, killing millions. At 90, Dan Ellsberg is still tirelessly advocating for the rights of whistleblowers and a free press, calling on the Biden administration to drop its case against Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder who published leaked information documenting war crimes, and its prosecution of Daniel Hale. Ellsberg concluded his recent interview on Democracy Now!,
"I've certainly been led more than almost anyone to appreciate the necessity of our First Amendment, our almost unique First Amendment, the protection of the freedom of the press, the freedom of the thought in this. You can't have democracy without it.
I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
German measles, Russian flu, Montezuma's revenge. And why do we say a foreign word whenever someone sneezes? Tomorrow, I'll take a look at swine flu, up close and personal. This is Les Nesbitt.
Legislation declaring Juneteenth a federal holiday is now law, after President Joe Biden signed a bill Thursday approved by Congress. Black Emancipation Day commemorates the end of slavery in the United States. While that's historic, forces of oppression still are at work. This year, multiple states approved bills that limit voting opportunities in Black communities and prohibit schools from teaching about the country's legacy of racism. In an interview with Yes Media, author and former financial advisor Kevin Matthews says making Juneteenth an official holiday is a nice gesture, but white supremacy still limits racial progress.
Anytime that people of color in this country have significant progress, there is almost always a swift reaction from those who are still in power or those who benefited from oppressing others.
Momentum for the federal legislation followed the Black Lives Matter protests sparked by the police killing of George Floyd last year. Juneteenth was made an official public holiday in the state of New York last October. Author and anti-racism educator Tim Wise also spoke with Yes Media. Wise is the author of Dispatches from the Race War and says his own family tree revealed slave owners who handed down documents that showed their lack of compassion when writing about the buying and selling of slaves.
And I think we need to grapple with that because we may not literally pass down human beings anymore, thank God, but we pass down the mentality that made the selling of human beings possible.
A celebration of emancipation started in Galveston, Texas, after news that slaves had been freed by President Abraham Lincoln reached the community 2 years after it was known in other parts of the country. In the southern tier, Tompkins County has been celebrating Juneteenth this whole week. Today at 6 p.m., a Juneteenth play prepared by county historian Carol Kamen and legislature chairwoman Leslyn McBean Claiborne depicts the events surrounding the Emancipation Proclamation. McBean Claiborne says she's in support of Juneteenth becoming a national holiday.
To be able to acknowledge that people were enslaved in this country, to make it real to everyone, so we need to give it as much value as we give to so many holidays in this country.
A link to the live stream can be found at TompkinsCountyNY.gov. I'm Michaela Savitt for New York News Connection.
One speeding ticket, Columbia County.
Columbia County, everybody gets speeding tickets. How else do they pay for the roads to get plowed in the winter?
And now here is your WGXC weather update. Your forecast for the weekend. Well, on Saturday, scattered showers and thunderstorms are possible after 11 a.m., it will be partly sunny with a temperature high near 83 degrees. Scattered showers, then isolated showers between 11 p.m. and 2 a.m. on Saturday night. It will be partly cloudy with a temperature low of around 61 degrees. And on Sunday, sunny with a high near 85 degrees. And Sunday night, partly cloudy with a temperature low of around 63. And that is your weather update from WGXC. 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in Greene and Columbia counties.
We love Roll Call, y'all. Boogie Down Productions, Rob Bass, Dana Dane, Molly Marr, Olatunji, Chuck D, Ray Charles, EPMD, EU, Alberta Hunter, Run DMC, Stetsasonic, Sugar Bear, John Coltrane, Big Daddy Kane, Salt and Pepper, Luther Vandross, McCoy Tyner, Biz Markie, New Edition, Otis Redding, Anita Baker, Thelonious Monk, Marcus Miller, Branford Marcellus, James Brown, Wayne Shorter, Tracy Chapman, Miles Davis, Force MDs, Oliver Nelson, Fred Wesley, Maceo, Janet Jackson, Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, Jimmy Jam, Terry Lewis, George Clinton, Count Basie, M2 May, Stevie Wonder, Bobby McFerrin, Dexter Gordon, Sam Cooke, Parliament Funkadelic, Al Jarreau, Teddy Pendergrass, Joe Williams, Wynton Marsalis, Phyllis Hyman, Sade, Sarah Vaughan, Roland Kirk, Keith Sweat, Cool Moe Dee, Prince, Ella Fitzgerald, Diana Reeves, Aretha Franklin, Bob Marley, Bessie Smith, Whitney Houston, Dionne Warwick, Steel Pulse, Little Richard, Mahalia Jackson, Jackie Wilson, Cannonball and Nat Adderley, Quincy Jones, Marvin Gaye, Charles Mingus, and Mary Lou Williams. We want to thank you all for making our lives just a little brighter here on We Love Radio.
Ms. Tanya Johnson is an independent media maker, media educator, and program administrator with a passion for cultural programming rooted in social justice. She has invested in the empowerment of youth and under-resourced communities for more than 20 years by leading developmental programs in the nonprofit sector that foster life skills, digital and media literacy, as well as providing media production training. She holds a bachelor's degree in communications from SUNY Albany and a master's degree in broadcasting, telecommunications, and mass media from Temple University in Philadelphia, PA. Woo, we both went to Philly for our master's programs.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we can talk about that. After returning home to her native New York in 2012, Tanya, yay, served as the co-director for Educational Video Center's flagship program, the Youth Documentary Workshop, curating high school students from across New York City to produce 20-minute social justice documentary films until 2016, which I might add, we should do every year. That's a program that could, we could certainly foster creativity with our young people for showcasing the happenings of our society. We should always remember in that way. So you've also worked as a freelance videographer, a teaching artist for various nonprofit organizations. You're a youth program manager and film reviewer for Black Star Film Festival in Philadelphia. I thought that was exciting. And as a Hudson City School District educated student, you have a really fabulous understanding of our history in Hudson. And of course, you're a Columbia County resident, and you were a visionary alongside your cousin Nganda Badilla, who organized Hudson's first annual Juneteenth celebration in 2020. So I'm just thrilled that we were able to have one this year, you know, because of our pandemic problems. I didn't think that would be a possibility, but you are proud now to be organizing Hudson's second annual Juneteenth celebration. But this time you have more people supporting you and helping you. And I'm so excited for you to be on the show today, because this week we'll be celebrating Juneteenth. And I just wanted to note that 1619 was the year that was documented as the first enslaved Africans coming to this new world. And if you play the numbers, like my mother and many other people in the county played before and currently do, if you look at those numbers, we are in June 19th at 619, and this is 1619. So that seems to have something to do with it too, in the aura of history. So please, Tanya, introduce as much as you can for us about this upcoming and past Juneteenth and celebrations, and specifically why you thought there was a need in this area specifically to have such an occasion, host such an occasion. And please share with us all of the great people who are helping you too, because they deserve kudos. We need it. And more so for just communion, if not for, you know, keeping our history intact.
Yeah, thank you for that introduction. And again, thank you for having me. I was, I guess I first want to speak to the video or the audio clip you played. I think I heard Ta-Nehisi Coates' voice, and a few others. I think it's funny, I'm down at the waterfront, and I think the Badilla person that you speak of, I think he's down here teaching a boxing taking a boxing session. I think he works at the high school as well. So I think I know who you're speaking of, and I'm watching him now. It's so funny. So,
I think he won the best row of placards.
Got it. Yeah. I think there's so many layers to unpack when it comes to U.S. history. And one of the things in that clip that, you know, I would speak to has to do with the original sin of America, not being the enslavement, but being the genocide of the Native Americans of this land. And that we would be the, the history of Black American ancestors would be the second sin, I would say, but deeply tied to the first one.
Absolutely.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the history of Africans coming to the New World prior to 1619, and that there is a deep history between Black folks and Native folks of this land. That still, I think, has a lot to unpack when it comes to the way that our histories are connected to each other, that we both assisted in each other's freedoms and sometimes adversely affected each other's freedoms. So yeah, there's a lot there to unpack, but for the sake of your question, to address your question, which is a lot. Okay, so if I begin with what, Juneteenth, the celebration, to begin there and why we started it. So last year, during the initial stage of the pandemic, Ngonda Badilla, aka Lady Moon, and I lived near each other. We lived near each other at the time on the same street. And so we would see each other in the community and had, we would have moments where we'd, pass each other's house and see each other and stop and talk about all of the, this what's going on, what does this mean? What does this mean for how we, sitting still and thinking about.
To interrupt, but I think there's some feedback happening with your.
How about now?
And the wind or something that we're hearing.
Okay, I'll close the window. How's that? Better?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so. We were in communication with each other a lot at the beginning stages during the pandemic, March and April. We had both moved back to the area, to Columbia County from the city. We were both living in Brooklyn prior to that, and both, having this passion and desire to use all of our skills and talents that, we've amassed. We graduated from Hudson, went away, developed ourselves as individuals and artists and programmers. And when we came back, we knew that we both wanted to bring our fullness to the community and serve, and had been, having loose conversations about what that would look like. And she had already started a couple of initiatives and we know that we wanted to do something bigger. And when the kind of Freedom Summer started bubbling around George Floyd's murder, a lot of protests were starting to bubble up. And the energy in the air, around Black Lives Matter was starting to reach a fever pitch. And there started to be a lot of initiatives in the city and around the, surrounding areas of Hudson, rallies and protests. And we were starting to notice that a lot of those initiatives and rallies were not led by Black people. And we were noticing that we didn't seem to be in the conversation. And we were, trying to figure out how do we engage our community as well as engage what is bubbling up to the surface at this point. And she initiated the idea of celebrating Juneteenth as a way of bringing attention to, we love all of, there's, everyone now has a Black Lives Matter placard and, it's all the rage to, put lawn signs and signs in business windows and that kind of thing. but we felt like it was superficial. And we felt like there's so much happening in a city that is not engaging the community around the needs of the community and what we want. And so she said, you know, she initiated the idea of having a Juneteenth celebration where we can come together as a community and talk about what do we want to say about what is happening. What is it? What does Black Lives Matter mean to us? What does it mean to support and be in allyship or solidarity with, you know, our community? And so from her, you know, pinpointing Juneteenth as a way of creating a mobilizing, you know, space around that, that's how that began. And so from there, you know, we contacted the community elders that we had grown up with and who were still on the ground doing amazing work in the community. And so we wanted to do this thing, and they rallied, you know, behind us and ensured that we could make it happen. And so we had the first celebration in front of Bliss Towers because, you know, symbolically as well as literally, it is like ground zero for where the Black community in Hudson still exists. And so we organized it as a block party in honor of one of our cultural, you know, rituals of having joy and being together. And we had this amazing day where it was, you know, we wanted it to be intergenerational, and we knew that we wanted, you know, all ages of the Black community to feel seen, feel heard, and to have a space and time to, you know, to celebrate ourselves and our joy. And it was really, you know, serendipitous because our mayor, Kamal Johnson, had just designated Hudson to a Juneteenth as a city holiday in Hudson, I believe the week before. And so everything just fell into place in the sense that this feels right for us to do this year. And this feels right as something for us to have a celebration around. At this point, Operation Unite still has the African Arts Festival in August, but there weren't any other festivities, cultural festivities that centered the Black community. And so we thought this would be, you know, an integral one that we could carry on beyond last year. And so that's how that began. It was a beautiful day. We had all kinds of activities for the kids. We had drumming, we had double dutch, we had coloring pages for the toddlers, we had a sprinkler, we gave out food, and we raised all this money just through the community. The community itself, we said, we want to do this thing and we need, you know, money to put it on, and people just donated. And it was such a beautiful show of support. And then we ended the day with a procession of elders into a community panel discussion where they shared some of what their advocacy and community struggle over the decades that they've been here were about and what they would like to see moving forward. And then the mayor spoke at the end. And so it was great. It was momentum and the spirit of like, we should keep this going. Unfortunately, Gonda, not unfortunately, she's in the next chapter of her life and moved to California with her husband. But I knew and she knew that we still wanted to continue this. And so one of the things, two major things that came out of that Juneteenth celebration last year was a Facebook group emerged for Black residents to start to share with each other. It's like, let's see each other. What are we doing? How are we doing? And so we started a Facebook page for the community so that we can start to be in community with each other. And the second initiative that came out of that was Grow Black Hudson, which was an initiative of Gonda's younger sister Nkula Badilla, who is a healer and an artist in her own right around, you know, she does a lot of bead work and she does healing work and with plants. Like, she's been a long time advocate and student of nature. And so she used her passion to start this initiative called Grow Black Hudson, in which she gets, you know, donations of soil and plants and seeds and teaches the Black and Brown community in Hudson how to develop and plant their own small gardens where they are. And so that initiative has grown into an amazing just beautiful community service. And so, you know, so that's the, that was the beginning of what this is. And so in the spirit of that, on the shoulders of that, you know, it felt right to continue that on. And so what, you know, what I did this year, you know, was to like just keep that legacy alive and say, this is something that we continuously need. And so this year we were fortunate, we were fortunate to be able to partner with folks that are organizing a jazz festival here called Melodious Thunk,